Okay, good evening, everybody. Barney, I don't see that Barney's on. Barney actually reached out to me last Friday and said he had a dentist appointment or had some dental work done, and asked me if I could switch with him. So I'm on tonight, and then he would be taking my place, which would, I think, I don't know, 5 weeks or so from now. So, yeah, that was last Friday when he asked me, and Jacqueline and I were getting ready to leave to go out of town to visit her family in Detroit. So I didn't really have much time to put something together, but I thought about it for a minute, and then I thought that maybe this would be a good time to sort of talk about my correspondence with our Russian friends, Vladimir and Michael. And I've been corresponding with them a little bit, and I know others have. In fact, I think, I know Mike's written a letter, and I think Roger has written a letter to them, too, about what they believe in. So I don't have anything structured. I've got some notes here, but I'll try my best to sort of talk a little bit about my couple emails to them. So today is Tuesday, October 13th, 2015. And I don't know what to title this. They have a website. And in fact, I think it's just a portion of their website. But thank you, Tony. Tony posted that. And, Jan had first introduced me to this site. And, if you click on that link, it'll take you to, I believe, which is just a portion of their website. The rest is all in Russian. And so I can't read it, but this part they actually did in fact translate from Russian into English, so you can read it. And the gist of what they believe is pretty much all in this site. And this is this portion of their website, that link is called As Two Pastorals. So Chip or whomever is trying to figure out a title for this, I guess we could say As Two Pastorals and possibly number one, because I the way this is going, I think that I'll have quite a bit of emails back and forth with them. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about what they believe, and then talk about some of the questions that I've asked them. So they've been Vladimir and Michael. They've been very wonderful in sending their emails back and forth. Of course, I haven't met them, but it would be nice one day. And even then, I think there might be a language barrier. But if you go to that site, I encourage anybody, if you don't know these folks, I don't even know their last names, but I know we don't like to name names. I know they're Vladimir and Michael, and I don't know the whole background on them, but again, like I said, Jan introduced me to their website, and in fact, Vladimir was supposed to visit Jan, and that sort of fell through, and that didn't get to happen. Mike just recently wrote them a letter, and I about a week ago for the first time sent them an email. So if you go to the site, it's pretty detailed, and it pretty much outlines in my mind on how they interpret the scriptures. And to sort of put it in a nutshell, they view Paul's last seven letters, in fact, as all written after Acts 28:28. But they do not believe that the truth of the mystery is embedded in Philippians, 1 and 2 Timothy, and Titus. And in fact, the only two letters that we can find the truth of the mystery is Ephesians and Colossians. And so those are two separate callings. The calling of the pastorals, or Philippians, 1 and 2 Timothy, and Titus, the sphere of blessing of that calling is in the heavens, as it says in Philippians, for our citizenship is in heaven. But then when we come to Ephesians and Colossians, they believe that, of course, as it is mentioned there, that, that the sphere of blessing, with that calling, Ephesians and Colossians, is at the very right hand of God, far above all. So, one of my first questions, to them, of course, was, how do they view Paul's last seven letters chronologically? And I told them they didn't have to give me dates. I think we certainly need to be careful whenever we assign, dates to certain letters, because we just can't get dates through the scriptures. But I asked chronologically in reference one to another and in reference to the book of Acts. And so, as I said, they do believe that all seven of Paul's last letters were in fact written after Acts 28:28. And in relation to one another, they said that Ephesians and Colossians, was in fact written, last, those two, possibly along with Philemon. And, Mike had brought attention to Philemon. And when you read through their website there, it's pretty, they're sort of on the fence as to where they want to put Philemon. They said because Philemon does not contain the theory of the mystery, that they don't have a problem putting it with Ephesians and Colossians. But so I think they're sort of on the fence on that. But so we'll just say that they are they're going to put Philemon with Ephesians and Colossians. So one of my first questions, of course, was, as I just mentioned, chronologically where you place them. And then I had a question about Demas. And so naturally my mind started thinking about Demas. Demas is mentioned three times in the New Testament. He's mentioned once in Colossians. He's mentioned once in 2 Timothy. And he's mentioned once in Philemon. And, in Colossians and in Philemon, Demas is sort of, by Paul's side as a fellow, laborer, in the Word. And so it's, thank you, Tony. Colossians, the verse in Colossians is 4:14. And that's, Paul's listing, he mentions Luke, the beloved physician, and Demas greet you. And then Tony's got Philemon, verse 24 up there, where it mentions Demas, my fellow laborer. And then when we come to 2 Timothy, Paul says, "For Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and has departed unto Thessalonica, Cretans to Galatia, Titus unto Dalmatia." So my question to them was, you know, do you have an explanation for Demas forsaking Paul in 2 Timothy, but now is sort of by his side in Colossians and Philemon? And of course, they think that 2 Timothy was written before Colossians and possibly Philemon. And they said that wasn't a problem for them. You know, Demas was reconciled back to them, and he was forgiven. And because when the truth of the mystery, according to Ephesians and Colossians, was revealed to him, the eyes of his understanding were opened, and so therefore he was reconciled back to them. And so, you know, that's, in my mind, I guess that's a fair answer. You know, I mean, we, exactly what happened with a lot of Paul's fellow companions, we just don't know. So that was my first question to them, and that was, or my second question to them, and that was their answer to me. And then another question I had. Sorry, I kind of have this bullet point. I hope that's okay for everybody. I know I just sort of jumped right into this, but I didn't have a whole lot of time to put something together. So I'll try my best to sort of go through some of these questions that I had to them. So again, my mind started thinking about, their reasoning with regards to the mystery, because certain Greek forms, very specific Greek forms and phrases that we see in Colossians and Ephesians, because they're not used in Philippians and 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, therefore the truth of the mystery was not known at that time, because it's not mentioned the way it's mentioned in Philippians, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. And an example would be far above all, or in heavenly places. I believe that Greek phrase, in heavenly places, is only used in Ephesians, actually. I don't even think it's used in Colossians. But on their website, they actually do have a number of charts, and one of the first charts is a chart that kind of outlines all of that. Another question to them was the hope of the heavenly Jerusalem, because it's only mentioned in two of Paul's pre-Acts 28:28 letters, because it's only mentioned in Galatians and Hebrews, can we say that hope or calling only applies to those Galatians and to those Hebrews? For example, in Galatians, we don't even run across the Greek form parousia. Abraham's mentioned, but nothing about the second coming of Christ. And the New Jerusalem, which is above, is mentioned at the very end there in that book. But if we just look at the Galatians in isolation, we're sort of wondering, well, what's going on? Their answer to that was that, that's not so much of a problem, because to them, the New Jerusalem is a reward. And so because it's a reward for the winners of Israel, they said, that message can be only directed to certain people. And so therefore, it doesn't have to be mentioned in every single letter. It can be mentioned in Galatians and not in Romans, and in 1st and 2nd Corinthians and Thessalonians and so forth, but in Hebrew. So that was their answer to them. And I actually have a pending email, 10 questions. My last email contained 10 questions to them. And one of the questions was 1 Thessalonians 4:17, the catching away. And I asked them, well, do they think that that's a reward? Because that catching away is only mentioned in 1 Thessalonians. And so my question to them was, well, were the Romans waiting to be caught away? Were the Corinthians waiting to be caught away? Were the Galatians waiting to be caught away, and so forth? Vladimir and Michael, they did respond to me today, and they said that they have to have some time to look into those 10 questions. But that was one of them. Another belief of theirs, it's interesting, and we'll have to turn to Ephesians 3 here, and this is a big one, and I've been spending a lot of time on this one. In fact, I was talking with Mike last week, and I asked him about this, and he's quite busy, but he said he'd get back to me on this. But if we all turn to Ephesians 3, and I just want to read those first three verses. This is an important one for them and as well as us. But the first three verses here say, Ephesians 3:1 says, "For this cause I, Paul, the prisoner of Jesus Christ for you Gentiles, if you have heard of the dispensation of the grace of God, which is given me to you word, how that by revelation he made known unto me the mystery, as I wrote afore in few words." Let me just back up here for a minute. I don't even think I mentioned this. I mentioned their website, but in my mind, I was not going to email them or correspond with them unless I thoroughly understood what they believe. And I think that's out of all fairness. I think that these two gentlemen clearly, very clearly, know how we interpret the scriptures. I believe Jan told me that they actually translated from English to Russian the entire alphabetical analysis by Charles Welch. So that's an amazing accomplishment, an amazing feat. And so in order to sort of best tell them what we believe is I believe that it's more than just telling them what we believe, but rather getting down to beneath the surface and looking very closely at some of these Greek forms and tenses and moods and so forth. And that's what I want to do here. So I'm going to read these first three verses again. "For this cause I, Paul, the prisoner of Jesus Christ for you Gentiles, if ye have heard of the dispensation of the grace of God which is given me to you ward, how that by revelation he made known unto me the mystery, as I wrote afore in few words." Now, they believe that that the dispensation in verse 2, the dispensation of the grace of God, in fact, began in Acts 11. And that it is different than the dispensation of the mystery. And so what I found out was that a lot of verses that I just sort of took it for granted that was referring to our hope and calling, they don't look at it that way. For example, one of them, just I'm thinking on the top of my head here, is a Colossians 1:5. I'm going to pull that up really quickly. Colossians 1:5 says, I've been under the belief that this is referring to this new gospel that began to be preached after Acts 28:28. And in that sense, they believe that also, but they just don't believe that this, Colossians 1:5, is referring to the truth of the mystery, but rather it's referring to that new calling that began after Acts 28:28 and the setting aside of Israel. But that calling, as I mentioned, is only contained in Philippians, 1 and 2 Timothy, and Titus there. And so a lot of these verses they look to as that calling. So these folks that Paul is writing to here, he's talking about here in Colossians 1:5, this hope that they had after Israel was set aside from Acts 28:28 until the writing of this letter. They said one of the prerequisites for having the mystery explained to them, or having the Lord, I believe, manifest it to them, is that they had to know, or they had to have known or been a part of this hope that was preached shortly after Acts 28:28 until Paul revealed the truth of Ephesians and Colossians. So let's go back to Ephesians 3 there. And so in verse 2, Ephesians 3:2, they believe that this dispensation of the grace of God began in Acts 11. So one of my questions, or the reason why I called Mike last week, was because I wanted to know a little more about this conjunction. The Greek form is hodi, and it's a conjunction. And it's translated how in verse 3, or how that. It's translated how that in the King James Version. And that is a conjunction there. And my question was, if verse 2 is entirely different than verse 3, because again, verse 2, in their minds, this dispensation was made known to Paul back in Acts 11, but here in verse 3, he's talking about the revelation he made known unto me about the mystery. And so what I found out was that of course a conjunction in its general sense, a conjunction joins clauses or sentences together. And so therefore the reason why this Greek form, this conjunction hodi, is used here is to join verses 2 and 3. And so This was in my last email, my first email to them, I asked about this, and they didn't really address that. They said that verse 2 here was conditional upon them receiving the truth of the mystery. But I had asked about that conjunction, how that, and why Paul uses this conjunction, if these two verses don't have anything to do with one another. And so they didn't answer it in the first email, but I sort of reworded it differently in the in my most recent email. So I'm hoping they'll address that. What I was thinking about this is, if the dispensation of verse 2 occurred well in the past, what's the connection here? Why use this conjunction? Why did Paul use this conjunction, how that, to link these two verses together? So, something a little bit, I kind of looked into this this conjunction, Hadi, and it can be causal, or it can be explanatory. In other words, it provides some elaboration. I emailed my friend Graham Thomason in London a few days ago, and he's the Greek guy over at the Chapel of the Open Book there, and he gives Greek lessons over there, and I wanted to get his input, and he emailed me back, and he said, in fact, he actually does have his own translation. I believe it's faraboveall.net. You go to the website faraboveall.net. He's translated the entire New Testament. It's actually quite amazing. But he did get back with me, and he said that he does look at this conjunction as being explanatory. In other words, it's going to provide an elaboration. It's going to expound upon the verse that came before it. And so typically, what follows is in some sense a continuation of what has gone before. And one example of where this conjunction is used is in Acts 28:28. And so if we go to Acts 28:28, we'll see sort of, in my mind, I believe that it's used similarly in Ephesians 3:3 there. So we all know Acts 28:28. Paul says, be it known therefore unto you, and then here's the conjunction, Hadi, that, so be it known therefore unto you, that the salvation of God is sent unto the Gentiles, and that they will hear it. So anyways, here's it being used as providing further detail or more information about what just preceded it. You know, be it known therefore unto you. Well, what? It's that the salvation of God is sent unto the Gentiles, and that they will hear it. So that's just one example. This conjunction is used, I believe, over 1,300 times in the New Testament, and I sort of got lost in looking at all of them, but that's just mainly covering the surface on this conjunction, and that was one of my questions to them. Why did Paul use this conjunction if those verses are not related? Now I want to get at a little bit about we're reading the King James here. I read the King James, but some of the other translations actually, I believe, sort of get it right here. So one translation, and many of you might not have it, maybe Tony does, but I want to look at the NIV. I want to look at how the NIV, for Ephesians 3, 2, and 3, I'm going to read it to you, and just sort of pay attention to how it sounds and how they use this conjunction. So in the King James it says how that by revelation, but let me read to you the NIV here. It starts off Ephesians 3:2-3. The NIV verse 2 starts off by saying, surely you have heard about the administration of God's grace that was given to me for you, that is the mystery made known to me by revelation, as I have already written briefly. So the translators of the New International Version looked at that conjunction as basically explaining what verse 2 was or is. So in verse 2, they say, surely you have heard about the administration or the dispensation of God's grace that was given to me. And then verse 3, that is Well, what was it? Well, it's the mystery made known to me by revelation, as I've already written briefly. So, they're linking the two, and they're saying that the dispensation of the grace of God, at least by their translation, maybe not by their interpretation, but their translation basically says that verse 2 is verse 3. Darby gets it down pretty good, too. Darby's translation reads, and I quote, starting at verse 2, "If indeed you have heard of the administration of the grace of God which has been given to me towards you, that by," so he translates the conjunction that by revelation the mystery has been made known to me according as I have written briefly. So, as I mentioned, this conjunction joins clauses or sentences, and so in my mind, I would love to hear what others have to say about this conjunction. If you have any thoughts on it, or if you look it up and study it out, that the way that I see the usage of this conjunction here is that it's clearly linking these two verses, and so that was another question that I had to these dear friends of ours in Russia. Because they say that dispensation in verse 2 is not what's being spoken of in verse 3. So I will await to hear what they say about that. And I asked them if they thought verse 3 was a new thought. So that's a little bit on Ephesians 3, 2 and 3 there. My next point or question to them was, so what they also believe is this. They believe that that the recipients of Ephesians and Colossians, or the Ephesians and the Colossians, when the Ephesians received the letter to them and the Colossians received the letter to them, that was the first time that they were hearing this truth. And so, of course, I had to look into this, and what I looked into was, we're going to stay here in Ephesians 3. Verse 2, Ephesians 3, 2, which says, "If ye have heard of the dispensation of the grace of God, which is given to me to you word," I looked at the mood and the tense of the Greek form translated heard, and so I looked into this, and then I realized that, well, wait a minute, they don't look to this as the new dispensation, but what I found out about that Greek form heard was that this Greek form heard is in the indicative mood and aorist tense, and it denotes past action. And so, therefore, the way that we see it, because we believe that dispensation is the dispensation of the mystery, that because it's in the indicative and it's in the aorist tense, it's denoting past action. And so, therefore, they had already heard it. What I wanna look at, and what word will be more applicable to them, and is Ephesians 1:18. And Ephesians 1:18 says, "The eyes of your understanding being enlightened, that ye may know what is the hope of his calling, and what the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints." Now, this is a verse that I believe they would say is referring to the truth of the mystery. And so, if they hadn't heard this before, or if they haven't been enlightened to this truth prior to receiving this, I wanted to look a little more closely at this verse and the word enlightened in this verse. The Greek form is photiza. And it is in the perfect tense, and so, Mikey, I see that you're on here. You're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong, But it is in the perfect tense. Well, that much I know that I'm right, but what I meant by, if you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that does the perfect tense, and I believe it does, but does the perfect tense refer to a state resulting from a completed action? And so, this verse, again, it says, the eyes of your understanding being enlightened, that you may know what is the hope of his calling and what the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints. Now, because it's a past action, the first part of this verse could read like this. The eyes of your understanding having been enlightened. So the eyes of your understanding having been enlightened. And so what I want to look at next is in this same verse, the word know. Now the King James translators, it's eido, and Barney has spoken quite a bit about this, in fact, I I called him this weekend when he was with his grandson, and I think they were getting ice cream somewhere, and I called him in the middle of the day because I wanted to ask him a question about this word no, but it's idle, and I believe he said that it can mean as a matter of fact. And so what I'm getting at here is in the King James here, it says that ye may know, almost as if it's not certain. Well, I looked into this this word know, and it also is in the perfect tense, which would denote action completed. But even though the action's completed, the results are continuing on. And how? So how is that it's all about Paul's prayer. You know, this enlightenment and this knowing are past actions. They've already happened, but the results are continuing on. And that's all about Paul's prayer in this entire letter. In the context of Ephesians, it's these saints have already been enlightened to this truth, but in the previous verse here, he's praying for growth. He's praying for knowledge, epigenosis, and that would be the results continuing on. So I want to read this verse on how I might translate it, or I'd rather have it translated this way. And I'll read this. I've got this written down here. The eyes of your understanding having been enlightened for your knowing, and then I've got parentheses, as a matter of fact, for your knowing, as a matter of fact, what is the hope of his calling and what the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the Holy of Holies, or as in the inheritance in the saints. So that's in looking at those tenses, I believe tell me that these actions have been completed. Their enlightenment has already taken place, and they already know what is the hope of his calling. They know it as a matter of fact, what is the hope of his calling and what the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the Holy of Holies. If we go to the previous verse, verse 17 says that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of glory, may give unto you the spirit of wisdom and revelation in the knowledge of him. Epigenosis means a full knowledge. A full knowledge in this great truth, the truth of the mystery, because of course they already knew it as a matter of fact, but growth comes through this knowledge. Growth comes through epigenosis. And there's two verses that actually speak to this. And the first verse I'd like everybody to turn to is Colossians 1:10. Colossians 1:10. And again, this the fact that epigenosis or full knowledge is a matter of growth, or I should say growth comes through epigenosis. Colossians 1:10 says that ye might walk worthy of the Lord unto all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge, epigenosis, of God. And the next verse that speaks to this, that growth comes through this knowledge, is Philippians 1:9. Philippians 1:9. Paul says in this verse, we all know this verse pretty well. He says, "In this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more." How can their love overfill more and more? Well, their love can abound more and more in knowledge, epigenosis, full knowledge, and in all judgment, or in all discernment, or in all depth of insight, as the NIV translates that. So in Ephesians 1 back there, it seems to me that Paul is praying for growth in this truth, in this great truth of the mystery, and not for initial enlightenment, since the enlightenment, according to the tense and mood, has already taken place. And this is all in context of, as Colossians 1:10 and Ephesians tells us as well later on in the letter, of the worthy walk. Ephesians 5, Paul says, "Arise, thou that sleepest, and Christ shall arise from the dead, thou that sleepest, and Christ shall give thee light," I believe it says. And then he goes on to say, "See then that ye walk circumspectly," or accurately. So they knew this truth. They knew it as a matter of fact. And so what Paul here is praying for is growth in this truth. And that comes through epigenosis, which I believe concerns, really, really concerns the walk. And I think Philippians 1:9 tells us that, because love is at the very foundation of our walk, and if it can grow, and thus our walk growing in epigenosis and discernment or spiritual insight, I'd say that that's what Paul's really praying for there. So that's a little bit, and I thank you, Gary, for that translation. That's a good one. So one last point here, and then I'll be done. I knew I probably only had a half an hour of material here. I found this sort of interesting. I found this interesting. Let's just go to these verses here. I of course, and all of us here link all of these verses together, these three verses, but let's go to Ephesians 1:4. Let's read that. Thank you, Tony, as always. Ephesians 1:4, it says, Paul says, "According as he hath chosen us in him before the katabale of the cosmos, that we should be holy and without blame before him in love." And that, as we know, that this calling predates or precedes Genesis 1:2, which is where the casting down or the overthrow of the creation there in Genesis 1:2 took place, and we know that that this is the only time in all the scriptures until we cross over Acts 28:28 that dispensational boundary line that we come to a calling that actually was in the mind of God prior to the katabale of the cosmos. But there's two other verses, and this is another question that's pending to them right now, is how do they look to these other two verses in comparison with Ephesians 1:4? And the other two verses are, let's start with 2 Timothy. It's 2 Timothy 1:9. 2 Timothy 1:9. Now, I link these verses, and I'll explain why I do. Sort of just might be an opinion of mine, but pray there's some truth behind it. At least it makes sense to me. So 2 Timothy 1:9 says, Paul says, "Who hath saved us and called us with a holy calling, not according to our works, but according to his own purpose and grace, which was given us in Christ Jesus, before the world, or before the ages, before time began." So when might that be? If you know, just a question to all of you is when was that? When did the ages begin here? Because our friends in Russia look to this verse they look to this letter, 2 Timothy, as being a part of a separate calling, a different calling than of the verse we just read in Ephesians 1:4. And so therefore, this calling is telling me that it goes before age times. So, just sort of keep that in mind. And the next verse is in Titus. And I know you, Roger, have probably already looked at this one because it's the second verse in Titus. And so, this verse says, in hope of eternal life, or I want to read it, and forgive me if you don't agree with my rendering, but I want to read it in hope of age-abiding life, and this is not age-abiding life contained in the Gospels, but just in hope of age-abiding life, which God that cannot lie promised before the ages began. So before the world began, before age time. So my question to them was: Do all three of these verses, Ephesians 1:4, 2 Timothy 1:9, and Titus 1:2? Now Ephesians 1:4 does not say before the ages; it says before the katabale, before the overthrow of the cosmos. But here in 2 Timothy and Titus, it says before the ages. So I asked, are all three of these verses, are all three of these verses, do they represent the same point in time? And I ask this because if 2 Timothy and Titus represent a different calling than Ephesians and Colossians, how is it explained then that both callings, going back before the katabale of Genesis 1:2, but are two separate callings? And so I sort of gave away right then and there how I interpret these three verses. I believe that at the katabale of the cosmos there in Genesis 1:2 was the starting point for God's plan and purpose for the ages. So therefore, the plan and purpose for the ages, or the ages, commenced at Genesis 1:2 at the katabale. So I link all those verses as referring to the same point in time. And I don't know if they do or not. Maybe they don't. Now, if they don't, then that would explain, it would make me better understand why then they would say, you know, they could possibly say, well, it's not referring to the same point in time, all these verses. It's referring to another point in time. And so therefore, it's not, Ephesians 1:4, it's not before the katabale, at some point after that. So, because if they do look to all those three verses at the same point in time, then they have to say that the calling of 2 Timothy and Titus, in fact, goes before, as Ephesians does, before the katabale of the cosmos. And, my conclusion on that is that both are referring to the same calling, of course, in the same point in time. I'm just looking here at my notes if I want to mention one more. Well, I'll mention this too. This is sort of interesting. Yeah. So Michael and Vladimir, they say that the calling of the pastorals, or Philippians, 1 and 2 Timothy, and Titus, share the same, now this is important, they say that the calling of the pastorals share the same sphere of blessing, which is the heavens, not heavenly places or far above all at the right hand of God, but the heavens, that this calling shares the same blessing as the church of the firstborn. And the church of the firstborn, I believe, is what they would say are Israel's overcomers, or the Israel's winners, and the church of the firstborn, I believe, is mentioned in Hebrews, and they say both represent an adoption. They actually list four adoptions within the scriptures. They mentioned the first adoption being Israel, the purchased people, and they shall inherit the earth. The second adoption is the church of the firstborn of the bride, and this adoption will inherit the city, the New Jerusalem. And then the third adoption is the Gentiles, the peculiar people, according to Titus. That is an adoption. And then the fourth adoption is the church, the body, and its inheritance in the Holy of Holies. So, I found that kind of interesting. Where my mind is going with all this is I'm sort of basing all this on this whole age, times, and katabale, and where they might place this calling of the pastorals, because they do place it in the heavens with the church of the firstborn. The only distinction they make is that while the church of the firstborn inherits the New Jerusalem, and the peculiar people don't. So that is it's 9:12 here in the East Coast, and so I'm gonna conclude that. And I just want to say this in case these fellows are listening from Russia. I told them in my email, I said I absolutely commend you two for all of this work. I was telling Mikey, I said this was not done overnight. I mean, these gentlemen, may have spent years and years on all this information, putting a lot of this together. And I told them, I said, one thing is certain. I said, we have the same hope and calling. We do. They see the calling of Ephesians and Colossians, and I think that's wonderful. Their hope is at the right hand of the Father in heavenly places, and so is ours. They just look at the other letters as different, and they draw all these distinctions. So I think it's wonderful. Couple emails to them so far has really allowed me to dig further into the Greek, and I don't know much about the Greek, and I really don't know much at all, but I learned a little more about some of these tenses and past action and so forth. So that's my study for this evening. I hope you all enjoyed it, and maybe there'll be a number two to this. I'm sure there will. Feel like I have three separate studies going on at once now, but if you want to title this chip, or whomever is titling this, Ask Two Pastorals Number One would be the title. So, let me close in a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much, as always, for your word. Thank you for these wonderful folks that you introduced me to a couple years ago. I pray that, that all of us, each and every one of us, continue to have a Berean spirit and search the scriptures. And not only just search the scriptures, but to apply all of that to our walk, apply all of that to our life, as it's so wonderfully laid out to us in Paul's last seven letters, especially Ephesians and Colossians, that worthy walk, walking circumspectly, walking accurately, awaking from the sleep. Yes, we can be sleeping at times, and we need to be awoken from that sleep, and so that we can walk a worthy walk, well pleasing unto you, Father. Thank you for your Son. Thank you for sending him to us. Thank you for his shed blood for our sins. In his name, I give you thanks and praise.